Hey, good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, Steele, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. It has been a beautiful month here in Wisconsin. The green is out, plants are budding, the world's alive.
Yeah, Steele, it's summertime, man. Things are happening. It's getting hotter. It's just the time of year.
It is. You're looking hairy and handsome.
Yeah, I got a it's a beard, Steele.
Oh, okay. I've heard of those. We're excited to welcome you to another episode of Off the Chain with Dave and Steele. This episode has a lot packed in. We're going to talk about some really important updates in this year's edition of Name of the Year. A winner has been announced.
Oh,
It was.
wow.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Wow, indeed. We've got Off the Chain Vacation. Since summer has started, we're going to be talking about vacation dreams and dream vacations. And we have another special episode of To the Limit when we discuss incredible human achievements. We've got an extended version of Unchained Melodies, and we've got, as always, some book wisdom.
I think Unchained Melodies is going to be excellent this week. I've probably put more thought into this edition of Unchained Melodies than anything else ever in my life.
I think, Dave, we may have worked more on this Unchained Melodies than we did on planning both of our weddings, so.
For me, that is certainly accurate. Yes.
Well, Dave, let's talk real fast. I need to give you an update. I know that you've been anxiously following the Name of the Year contest this year.
I check it daily. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know they came down to the Elite Eight.
Oh, wow.
And
Wow.
in the Boultron Regional, it was Cherry's Waffles Tennis versus Pier Battista Pizzaballa, who's a reverend. In the Sithole region, there was Dr. Electron Kabubu and Lancelot Super Sad Jr. In the Dragon Wagon Regional, Handsome Monica and Infinite Grover. And in the Crotch Tangle Regional, Amanda Miranda Panda and Miraculous Powers. As we all know, Amanda Miranda Panda and Infinite Grover made it to the Final Four. And Lancelot Super Sad and Cherry's Waffles Tennis advanced. In the Final Four, Lancelot Super Sad Jr. narrowly edged Cherry's Waffles Tennis. And Amanda Miranda Panda obviously crushed Infinite Grover. And Dave, this was really epic. It was a week-long struggle. It was a battle. Lancelot Super Sad Jr. from Connecticut, the fine state of Connecticut, faced off against Amanda Miranda Panda from Caldwell, Idaho. They were both arrested, I think, for different crimes. So they entered the public record through ignominious means. But the votes came in, and we have a new 2015 Name of the Year. You want to hazard a guess, Dave, as to who you think emerged victorious?
I don't see how Amanda Miranda Panda could not win. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Lancelot Super Sad Jr. I mean, the fact that he's a junior carries a lot of weight for me. The fact that he was not the first Lancelot Super Sad.
it must have worked well enough for the first, whereas like, yeah, I've enjoyed this name. I'm
Got to
gonna
pass
pass
it
it
on.
along.
I wanted a junior Lancelot. Another very sad Lancelot. So, yes, Miranda Panda is our 2015 Name of the Year. She won in a landslide. And I just wanted to wish her congratulations. An amazing, amazing victory. She's joining the ranks of some really incredible, incredible human beings with some great names. And I wish you all the best for the rest of the year and beyond.
I just hope that this win is able to help her get her life on track. She seems like she had some issues with shoplifting and theft is kind of how she got out there. But I would think that this victory would inspire her to, I don't know, do something more.
You'd hope, you know. I mean, Caldwell, Idaho is pretty much the greatest city in America. And so she's got a lot of economic opportunity coming her way, I'm sure. The town's probably going to throw a parade, get the key to the city. I think things are about to turn around for old Miranda Panda.
I like that every time you've said it, you have not said it correct, and that's wonderful.
It's true. So that's an update on the name of the year. The next thing we want to talk about, though, is summer plans. Summer is most famous for vacations. It's the time to get out, to see the world, to enjoy the beauty that the planet has to offer us and the great weather this time of year. And we want to talk about some off-the-chain vacations. Dave, I know that you're a big aficionado of the road trip.
I love the road trip. I've been on lots of them. You know, I went to school in Utah back when I was living in New Jersey. So at least twice a year, we were going to do a pretty sweet road trip. But the love of the road trip all comes from one epic road trip in 1987.
Of course it does.
I was 7 years old, Steele. I was living in Houston, Texas. I hadn't seen a lot of the world yet. Let's say you're seven. What's your number? Where do you want to go? Where do you want to see?
You want to see, if He-Man was real, you would want to go to whatever his castle, Grayskull. You'd want to go to Castle Grayskull. Yes. You'd want to see something that had action figures and or animated characters. You'd want something with lots of sugar.
Yes.
I don't know. Stuff blowing up.
You're hitting everything that I needed. And this is the epic 1987 2-week-long vacation. We'd never been on a 2-week-long vacation before. We never went on one again. We retired the 2-week-long vacation after this trip because we'd reached the pinnacle. We hit.
And when you're talking we, Dave, who are the principals here? How many people are going on this trip?
This is my parents, mom and dad, my two brothers and my sister. I'm the youngest.
Oh, nice. So they're taking four kids with them. That's brave.
Four kids in a custom van. You remember custom vans?
Yes.
Steel?
Yeah.
Beautiful. I'm going to send you a picture of our van because it's beautiful. Light blue with dark blue stripes. This is back in the time before you really had to wear seatbelts. So we would lay on the floor of the van to take naps.
Did you have a metal wheel well in the back that the wheel was stored in?
Yeah, on the very back door. You know what it is. There was a ladder at
the
back.
There's a ladder. You got to climb to the top just in case.
And there was a slot to put a TV, and we never put one in there, but it was my dream. Like, why isn't there a TV there? I always wanted a TV.
Yeah, you could have watched Wapner.
So we travel. We hit up all the natural sites, everything you need to see. Carlsbad Cavern, Petrified Forest, that huge meteor crater in northern Arizona, Bryce Canyon, the Grand Canyon.
Bryce Canyon's incredible, and the Grand Canyon.
We rode on mules through Bryce Canyon.
Wow.
It was fantastic.
Was that your first time aboard a mule, or had you had lots of mule experience before as a seven-year-old?
That's my first time, Steele. I know that's hard to believe, but 87, first time I rode a mule. And actually,
never went back. That's the only thing you ride now.
But the culmination of the vacation, Steele, and the whole time we're driving, there's a lot of driving. And the whole time my mom she's reading books out loud to us. Do you know the Great Brain series? You ever read those?
Yes. Yeah. Fantastic.
Really good. So she's reading them to us as we're driving. My grandparents meet up with us at some point. They got a sweet motorhome. You can watch movies while you're driving. And none of us will leave the van to ride with my grandparents because my mom's reading The Great Brain to us, and it's too good.
That sounds fantastic. You know, I think something about road trips, they're particular to place. Like, there's no place built for road trips like the American West because of the distances involved and that kind of unending desert with occasional awesome things interspersed. It's really remarkable. If you want to do a road trip, the American West is the best place, I have to say. And that's not being provincial. I really think that's the best place on earth for a road trip.
No, it makes sense because you're driving through northern Arizona, you hit up the meteor crater, you drive a while, you hit up the Petrified Forest, you drive quite a while, you hit up the Grand Canyon. There's nothing in between except for just desolation and your mom's reading The Great Brain.
And the thing is, because it's a road trip, the central thing is the road. Like, if you're traveling somewhere else that's more densely populated, it's city trip, or you're driving past and happy. Like, you want the road trip to be just mostly you and the road until you stop for stuff. And that's what the West can give you.
Yeah, you really want the open road. Still, I don't know how many times I've leaned back, grabbed my steering wheel, and said, ah, the open road. Because when it's open, it's beautiful. But when you're back east, you're not hitting an open road. It's not going to happen.
I don't think Chris Christie's ever said, ah, the open road. And look at him. I mean, that'd have done him some good.
Yeah, I think he'd be a much happier person.
Yeah, laid back a little.
All road trips, of course, lead to California. It is the destination. Of course, we saw Disneyland. We went to Universal Studios. Do you remember the original Battlestar Galactica television show?
No. I'm sorry. You're asking the wrong guy. I didn't know there was more than one. I didn't even know there was one.
Oh, there... There was an original one, and they had a ride at Universal Studios. So I had a picture of one of the evil robots up in my room for years.
Cool.
And Knott's Berry Farm, we did everything you could in SoCal. And
that's fantastic, Dave.
It was just the best.
Your parents, well done. On our road trips, we would listen to books on tape. Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites, we listened to all of those. You remember those? Garth?
Yeah. Class. Yes.
And we used to listen to Bill Cosby tapes. Those are still fond memories, despite the terrible fall of the Cosby reputation. And anyway, we don't need to get into that. Let's talk about dream vacations, though, quickly, Dave.
Yeah.
Some places you'd love to visit or see before you die. And I'll start with mine. For me, the place that I would love to go, that I just want to see, is Istanbul, Turkey. I don't know what it is about it, but I would just love to visit. In particular, the Hagia Sophia, that beautiful Byzantine architecture and the remarkable, I don't know, the arches, the arabesques. It's just a gorgeous golden-domed house of wisdom.
Okay. Have you ever been to anywhere similar that also intrigued you and you got there and you're like, now I got to go to Istanbul? Or
no, I haven't really. I've only read about it and seen photographs. There was a great National Geographic feature maybe 10 years ago that really caught my interest. Something about Turkey and Greece, it really appeals to me. I think the food I would love, the Mediterranean food, is fantastic. Really good for vegetarians as well. Turkey, maybe not so much. But we have all of our neighbors now, like where we live, are Turks. And some of our best friends now, and they're from Istanbul. So we're always talking about Turkey. And I think we've got neighbors, we got places to stay now when we go to Istanbul.
Do you feel like it's going to happen? Will you achieve this dream, or is it kind of just out there?
It's going to happen in the next 5 years. We were thinking about doing it before Cedar was two, so he could fly for free. It's like a 20-hour flight with the baby, which is going to be awful. But the other thing we could do is when he gets really good at eating, just be like, all right, you're going to go stay with Grandma and Grandpa for a couple of weeks, and Laura and I go to Turkey.
People do that all the time. I don't know if I can handle it. I don't think I can handle leaving my daughters for 2 weeks.
I don't know but, either. I think I'd want to take him. But I don't know. I think it will happen, though. How about you, Dave? What's your dream spot?
Me and Ariane, my wife, we've wanted to go to Peru for a long time. I love the ancient ruins. I've been to Mexico, southern Mexico, with our friend Matt. And we went to a bunch of these ruins together. And it was just so intriguing to me. And Peru, just the climate, the environment, it's got this very low coast. And all of a sudden, you're up at 10,000 feet. And I want to go to Machu Picchu.
Oh, man. So I want to know, I guess I just help me get straight on the ruins. So when we're talking about Mexico, these are Aztec ruins. That's the great civilization. Or Mayan? Where are the Maya?
The Aztecs are a little further north than where I was. I went to all the way down the southern, the Yucatan Peninsula, and that's all Mayan. So it was all Mayan ruins. And we went to probably five or six different ruin sites. And some of them are highly guarded, still touristy. And some of them you could just kind of walk around and do almost whatever you wanted. And it was just really neat to see these ruins of ancient civilizations. And it's just odd to think of how the civilization collapsed and where is everybody.
Totally. And the Machu Picchu, isn't that the big, huge stoneworks way up on the mountains? And those were the Incas that built that?
Yeah, that's the Incas. And it's, you know, it's a famous ruin. I would assume one of the most famous in the world. And it's at very high elevation, almost 8,000 feet. So it's pretty high up there.
Holy cow.
And it's mile beautiful. And
do you know anybody that's been? Is this a place that you've had reviews of from friends or family? Or
I do. Our friend Stephanie, you know her. Yeah. She's been to Machu Picchu. Actually, one of my favorite doctors I work with is from Peru, okay. Dr. Magoto. So I'd go hang out with Dr. Magoto in Peru. It'd be awesome.
That'd be great. So is this going to happen? Are you going to take the girls?
Yeah, I want to. I don't want to go without them. I want them to see it. I want them to experience it. So it just depends on kind of the timing. It's going to happen, but it might not be for a while because I guess I want them to be able to really experience it and enjoy it.
And they do have a direct flight from Snowflake to Machu Picchu, right? I mean, that runs regular.
Yeah, it's a helicopter line, actually. You just jump in the chopper and you're there. It's about a 6-hour flight, so it's really nice.
So, Machu Picchu, a dream vacation amidst the clouds. And Istanbul, traveling in the Balkans. I mean, we've got it covered.
So, Steele, I'm excited because can we just jump right into To the Limit? Because I've got a special guest just for that section of the show.
I cannot wait. Dave, let's talk. Let's go to the limit. What do you have for us that's at the limits of human achievement?
So, Steele, I'm a bit of a runner. I'm not fast or athletic or tall or any of those things, but I like running. And so not that long ago, I read a book called Born to Run, where this guy talks a lot about the Tarahumara Indians, natives in northern Mexico. Have you heard about these guys at all?
I have heard a little bit about the book, and the idea is basically that as human beings, we were evolved to run basically all the time, everywhere.
Yeah, that's the idea. And one of his main premises is that we're running in the wrong way. He doesn't think we should be wearing these huge, soft running sneakers, but that we essentially should be running with almost no padding. It kind of started a craze, like a barefoot running craze. But what's even more interesting is that my wife, probably like 10 years ago now, she went on an awesome backpack trip to see these guys. And she always talks about it to me. She always talks about the Tarahumara Indians. And I just roped her in. She's right here still.
Hey,
hello.
How's it going?
Ariane, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, life is good.
We're glad that you made your debut appearance on our podcast. Finally good to have Dave's better half on.
Yeah, I'll talk about runners. I hate running. I'm not a runner.
Me too.
I've met some really good runners.
Is it Tarahumara or Tarahumara?
Well, they call themselves something totally different, but okay. The rest of the world calls them Tarahumara, something like that.
So why'd you go down there? What happened?
I took a backpack trip down there with a guy named Dave Holiday and 9 or 10 other people just to stay with these people and hike around and bring them some goods. They live in a really, really remote part of northern Mexico. It's near the Copper Canyon area, and it's really high elevation, and they have at least, this was like 9 years ago, so they had been experiencing a lot of drought and just having to move from their little villages, and so we were able to bring them some basic supplies, but mostly it was just because I wanted to go and it would be really neat to meet these guys. So we stayed with several different families in different villages as we backpacked through these mountains that were, you know, super high. It was really beautiful. They mostly make their living raising sheep and corn, and they make violins, and the men wear skirts, and it's delightful. They wear these little tiny white triangle shaped skirts. And they're famous for wearing these sandals that are made from old tires.
So hold on. So, Ariane, you just breezed through like 15 amazing facts as if they were just ordinary. I want to take a second. So first of all, had Born to Run already come out at this point? Like, how did you know that this was a place you wanted to visit?
I don't know when Born to Run came out, but this was 2006. Oh, it hadn't come out.
So you were ahead of the curve.
Apparently, yeah. Well, when I worked at Anasazi, there's Dave Holiday is a survivalist who also works with Anasazi. So he was planning the trip, and I hopped on just because I spoke Spanish. He like let me come because of that. So I didn't plan this trip at all, but Dave Holiday he'd gone down there to see these people many times.
Okay, and so you tagged along, and the first impression was all these dudes are wearing white triangle shirts and wearing old shoe sandals. Yeah. Earl Tire sandals.
And really colorful, multicolored tops. Really blousy. Yeah.
So did you do fashion shopping while you were there?
No, they didn't. They didn't sell their goods. They hardly had enough for themselves. So I just admired, you know.
They sound like they're dressed like maybe 1980s women tennis stars. That's what it sounds like.
Well, what's interesting is that the women don't wear the skirts. I mean, they wear skirts and dresses, but they don't wear the short white triangle skirts. I think it allows for just really fast running, and the men do most of the running. You know,
why do they run so much? Why are they running all the time? Do you know?
I don't know.
Is it fear? I don't know.
From what I could gather, the women usually stay at home, and the men run a lot. And I guess they just—I have no idea.
From what I understand, reading the book is they're kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and to facilitate communication, to get supplies, they run. They don't have animals to ride on, and the terrain is much too rough for like a horse or something. It's very steep canyons. It's beautiful, right?
Yeah, it's beautiful. And yeah, really steep canyon. So at one time we were descending into this canyon from really high. I mean, it's like 8,000-10,000 feet elevation, and descending this really steep canyon. The whole canyon, as we looked across the way, we could see just switchbacks just all over the other side. So they just, and they don't have, like Dave said, they don't have a lot of resources. So for communication, for getting things in and out of their villages, they just go on foot, right? And schools as well. So the kids, from when they're little, are used to just traversing these crazy switchbacks to and from school several miles. So it's something that starts really young. So here's this group.
We're talking about running as the mode of transportation, really. You're not talking about, like, this isn't like running for leisure.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. It's a necessity. And over time, they figured out they can, you know, get these tire sandals, and that probably allows them to run, you know, protect their feet a little bit. But they're really, really basic sandals. But, you know, there's this group of 10 white American people with our big backpacks, and we're descending this switchback, and slowly. I mean, it took us a long time. We're going from the top of the mountain down to the very bottom, this little tiny village. It took us a few hours, probably. And in the meantime, like every, I don't know, half hour, these men would just zoom past us, going uphill, you know, just running, no problem. And we're like barely moving because it's real treacherous terrain. It was incredible.
Wow. So what kind of body type are we associated? Are we thinking like the long, lean runners, or what kind of?
Well, they're Indians in northern Mexico. They're small people. They're not tall and lean. They're little. They're not wimpy. They look like a short runner. I mean, you know, lean and muscly. But not big at all. Sure. Maybe 5'3", you know, just little guys.
Cool.
But these guys are epic runners because they do it because they have to, but also they have races. They'll have competitions in the towns, and you know, it's a somewhat of a status symbol from what I gather in this book, that you're the fastest runner, that you can run, I don't know, like 50 miles and you can do it faster than anyone else. It's not you can run 50 yards faster than anybody else. Like, they don't care about that. But if you can run 50 miles faster than anybody else, then like you're awesome.
So this is endurance. This is like a group of people who endurance running is the thing they do and they take great pride in.
Well, I don't know if I should share this story because I don't have any factual base, but my friend Dave Holliday told me this story about a man that we stayed with at the bottom of this canyon that I was just talking about. That we were surprised when we came down this canyon because there were a lot of little sheet metal roofs, which is something we hadn't seen yet. It's very, very modern, right? And so Dave was telling me that in this particular village, several years before, a friend of Dave's had taken them to Tucson to compete in some type of marathon or some type of race. One man in this village won or did extremely well. And so they asked him what he wanted for his prize. I don't know who asked him this, but he said, oh, I want a metal roof. That would be awesome. And so he was the first man in town in the village to get a metal roof. They took it down in pieces, you know, and had to reconstruct it on his home. But we ended up staying with that particular man. So he was the first in the village. And then in time, that whole village had little corrugated metal roofs.
Because they kept going to Tucson and winning marathons one after the other.
Well, I'll go do one now, too. I need a
roof. Going to go win me a roof in the Tucson Marathon, honey. I'll be back in a month.
So the premise of the book is it talks about these guys and their amazing endurance. And it talks about how they never get injured. they really get injured running because he feels like they're using proper running mechanics. They're landing on the front of their foot rather than modern runners. Lots of times, because we have the padding, you'll land very firmly on your heel. Yeah. And he feels like that's like bad wear and tear. So the culmination of the book, he's going through all this stuff. And throughout the book, he's training so that he can run a race with these natives in northern Mexico. And his goal is just to finish this 50-mile race through this rough terrain at high elevation. And it's a really compelling read because he's presenting this case for how we should be running. And he's presenting this case that humans were designed for endurance running. When you read the book, you're like, I need to go for a 50-mile run. What am I doing?
Yeah, so he's saying it's not just this group of tribes people who have an evolutionary adaptation, or because of their environment, they've developed this running adaptation. He's saying, as human beings, we're all runners?
One of the most interesting things that he shares, like anecdotally about this, is a man with some tribe in Africa. I wish I could remember exactly what it was. But he goes on a hunt with this group of people. And the hunt is essentially they run after an animal. They just keep running after this animal. They don't stop. The humans are able to cool down. We have sweat. We drink water. You're able to cool your body. But this animal is used to just sprinting short distances. So they could never catch it over, 100 feet. But running over a number of hours, eventually this animal overheats and dies. They just have to go and cut its throat. And that's how they're able to hunt. One of his, I guess, theses to the book is that we were evolved to run.
That makes sense to me. I saw there's the Human Planet series, and they have a kind of segment on this, like endurance hunting. And that's essentially what our ancestors used to do in African savannas. It's the absolute opposite, Dave, of what you were talking about with WALL-E, the future of human civilization last week.
It is. But it's exciting. Like I run in like these sandals that are like tire sandals, except fancier because I paid like $50 for them. I changed how I run. And I'm not running 50 miles, but the book maybe changed how I run, and hopefully it'll enable me to be healthy running going forward. But I don't know if I totally buy into it.
So I got some Vibram barefoot sole shoes myself, Dave.
Oh yeah,
I do. I don't ever run shoe? In them. My boss wears toe shoes to work every day though, and a purple shirt. It's hardcore. Well,
you definitely work at a university then.
Hey, so speaking of desert canyons, this ties really well in with my contribution to the Limits this week.
All right.
My To the Limits story is one that you're probably both familiar with, but it's the story of Aaron Ralston.
Do you remember this?
Not there yet. No, oh. I have a terrible memory. I remember the name.
We've watched the movie.
Oh, you did? What's the movie called?
127 Hours.
Yes.
Oh. I see, I never saw the movie, but I read the news story when it first came out, and I dug up the actual, like, original news story. And here's the story. For those of you who haven't seen the movie or have been living under a rock, get it? So Aaron Ralston was hiking in a little 3-foot-wide section of the Blue John Canyon up in Utah, and a huge boulder that was somewhere between 800 to 1,000 pounds shifted and pinned his right arm in a crack of the wall. And 6 days later, he realized the only way he could get out was to cut off his own arm with his pocket knife. So he made the cut below the elbow, tied on a tourniquet himself, administered third aid from his backpack, and rigged some anchors, rappelled 60 feet down to the canyon floor, and then began to hike back to his truck.
Awesome.
A rescue helicopter spotted him 7 miles later. He takes a 12-minute chopper flight to a nearby hospital. They said he was clearly tired, but asked only for water. He climbed out of the helicopter and walked to the emergency room, his arm bandaged in a makeshift sling.
Incredible.
It's intense. Excellent movie, but a little bit intense to see what he has to do. Because the pocket knife can cut through his flesh, but it's not going to get through bone. So he literally had to break his arm, and he did it. I don't know how he did it. Naturally, anytime you have a conversation about this, the next question is, could you do it? And I don't know. I don't know if I could.
Well, you know what the alternative is. Got a little motivation.
Yeah, it's true. You either do it or die, I guess, Ariane.
True.
You put it in those terms. You have a, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I imagine, would he have to have fainted or passed out a couple of times, Nurse Dave?
In the film, I think it shows that he did. I would think with that amount of pain that you'd black out. Syncope. It'd have to happen. I don't know how you could do that. You just have to be awesome.
The thing that I wonder about is, this was the part of the story, it mentioned that there were some searchers that went back afterwards to try to recover his severed arm. And they're the ones who said how large the boulder was. But imagine being the searcher and your job is to go find the guy's arm. Would that be, I don't know what that would be like.
Just follow the trail of blood back to this horse, I guess.
Yep, we found it. I guess this is probably his. Don't see any other arms laying out here.
Dull pocket knife. This fits what he said. Yeah.
I guess it's Aaron's. Wait, no, this is a left arm. He said he cut off his right arm. You know, Dave, I wrote a poem about this guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I did. It's called On Endurance for Aaron Ralston. And it's got an epigraph from Robert Neves, a professor of exercise physiology. He says, I do not feel there is a limit. Here's the poem. There's a body inside our minds, though what the unminded body can do always surprises. A man, trapped by a sudden landslide, removes his broken arm just below the elbow using a pocket knife. It was stuck, he said, and I wanted to get out. The arm wasn't coming, so he left it behind. It was a strategic decision. There must have been a moment or several in which the mind could not avoid hearing the dull scratch, inadequate blade on glistening bone, the bone his own. How does he keep the right hand in the dark? How does the left hand continue its doing? There must have been blood, sinew, a ferocious smell, the wish to keep all that could be saved. There must have been a moment in which the mind concluded that the body was not shrinking, that a network old as the mind and as worn by experience was being disrupted by a massive denial of service attack. The goal, he said, is not to reach the mountain's peak. And still, the knife proceeds, driven by the mind's calculations. Have you never desired to know the earth, to shift only what will be budged, and cut loose the rest? The goal is to improve the man, if thy right hand offend thee. What more could be lost beyond the arm he shed? Remember this, he tells you, the mountain is just a means. The end, I'm telling you, it's us.
That's great, Stillman.
Thanks,
yeah,
Dave.
I love it.
The whole time I was thinking about, Ariane, do you remember what he says his motivation was, how he was able to do it?
Didn't he have a dream?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was his dream? Do you remember?
No, he really did. He had a dream where he saw a little boy calling him father, calling him dad or daddy or something. And so he said, I have a son I'm yet to have. I must get out of here.
Wow. So the desire for procreation is what got him out of the canyon.
That did.
That motivates just about all of us, I would say, in different ways. I'm sorry I ruined that. It's a great moment.
Because still, no, think about it. You have a son. Like, when I just was thinking a moment ago, like, could I do it? And I was thinking maybe no. But then if I think of it in terms of I need to get back to my daughters, then I could do it. Yeah. I think I could do it.
It's true. I think the things that...
Back to your wife.
That'd get me through maybe one bone, not both of them.
You'd be able to find somebody else, probably better, Ariane. It's the daughters they really need, Dave. Hey, well, that's To the Limit this week. We talked about the barefoot runners of northern Mexico and Aaron Ralston.
Oh, hold on. Ariane's going to, I think you're going to go, right?
Yeah, I'm going to go. Yeah. All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ariane. Thanks for joining us. Next thing we want to talk about, we have a very special edition of Unchained Melodies. At the top of the episode, Dave mentioned that he's been spent more time planning this and thinking about this than maybe anything he's ever thought about in his life, including his nursing PhD. And I understand why. Once you find out, this Unchained Melodies, we're calling the Fight Edition.
Oh, man. So, Steele, I emailed you a question earlier in the week, and I thought it was good. I think it's great.
It is a great question.
And then you came back at me with another one that just blew my mind. I was like, whoa, I put so much thought into this. I still am second guessing my choices. Like, in my mind right now, I was like, are you sure? Is that really what you want to do? But I'm just going to go with what I picked, and I hope that it works. I hope it's good enough.
You're going to have to live with the fallout. Here's my question for you, Dave, and this was inspired by something from my real life. When I lived in Boise, Idaho, after I graduated from college, before grad school, I worked as a land surveyor. And I worked on a crew with this really awesome guy named Jesse. I'll try to have him on the show sometime. He had been a college wrestler, an All-American, and had almost made the U.S. Olympic team as a freestyle wrestler. And then he got into MMA fighting. And so he was an MMA fighter on the side while we were surveyors. We used to always listen to music in the truck together. We had similar tastes in music and literature. And he was talking about his next fight. And I was like, what's your entrance music going to be? And he's like, I don't know. So we talked about his fight entrance music. And eventually we said, what about this? Because everybody plays like super aggressive rock or hip hop or just like very testosterone music. And he's like, I don't want to do that. I want something a little different. And so eventually, together, we settled on this song, which will blow your mind.
So, Steele, years ago when this album first came out, I was driving through some part of Phoenix with my windows down, and I had this bumping. I was into it. And it's the first time ever that the guy pulled up beside me, African-American dude in his 50s, just like cool-looking guy. And he looked over at me and he said, yeah, man.
Yeah. You're like, finally, I earned some respect. Nice job. Yeah, that's a totally unexpected choice, but it's a great entry. It's like, it's kind of tongue in cheek, but it's got that great kind of, you can imagine yourself like walking to that beat, and then it's kind of a fake falsetto. Oh man, it's so good. So that was Jesse's song. It was Spoon's I Turn My Camera On. That was his entrance music for his next fight.
Did he win?
I don't recall if he won or lost that fight. There was a fight when I was working with him in which he was knocked unconscious, had his nose like knocked back into his face and had to have emergency reconstructive surgery. So I hope it wasn't that fight. And if it was, I hope it wasn't the music that was responsible.
So I went all testosterone. You remember we used to listen to this song in college, and I don't know if it was testosterone or what. All of us would end up like jumping around the room, probably breaking stuff with our shirts off. It's a little bit embarrassing to talk about now, but this song still gets me pumped up. If I'm getting ready to fight someone, I've got to hear Motley Crue kickstart my heart.
that would be the moment I enter the ring if I was coming out to that song. That'd be so good.
My favorite line in that whole song is "skydive naked from an aeroplane." Oh. So good.
Yeah, Dave, you can't listen to that shirt with your shirt on. That's a rule.
No, I took it off. I'm having to put it back on right now.
Yeah. Hey, well, Dave, I wasn't able to settle on one choice, so I need your input. I have two selections that were the options here. I'm going to play a little bit from each, and I want your vote on this one. This one, I'm still up in the air. The first choice for me was by Dizzy Rascal. He's a kind of grime rap artist from England, and the song was called... It's actually... the record was called Boy in the Corner, so it could be about boxing in a way. The song is called Fix Up, Look Sharp. Look sharp, don't make me bring a bit side, get dark. Hear the bang, see the spark. Duck down, lay down, just stop down. Fix up, look sharp, don't make me bring a bit side, get dark. Hear the bang, see the spark. Duck down, lay down, just slow down. I got the big beat. I hear the sound. Yeah. I got the big beat. I'm ready to fight right now. I don't care who it is.
Yeah, he's cooking. That guy's cooking.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, what are you going to put up against this? I don't know what could win.
Okay, so here's my second choice. I was wondering if this would be the other one. This is Rat-a-tat. The song is Loud Pipes. Vision for that one is I grow my hair out really long. It's in like a greasy ponytail. I have a real long Fu Manchu, and I'm just kind of slinking down slowly to the ring. I'm a real dirty, gross-looking dude.
So that would take a significant time investment. So I support that, but I think you go with a Dizzy Rascal until you can get to the appropriate grooming for the second song.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the advice. I think you're probably right. So let's go with my choice is Dizzy Rascal. We got Fix Up, Look Sharp. We got Kickstart My Heart. And we have Jesse's great choice of I Turn My Camera On. Three great ring entrance songs for your next fight.
I think we can all agree that the greatest ring entrance of all time is Apollo Creed, Rocky IV, James Brown singing live at the fight, Living in America. So you can't top that. Just try and get near that.
It's true. That's the gold standard.
My original question I sent to you, which I think it's got multiple layers if you start to think about it. What music would you want playing in the background if you're getting into an actual fight?
Wow. Yeah, this was a pretty good question, Dave. I had to give this one a lot of thought. Tell me about the inspiration for this question for you. Have you been bullied at work?
I remember years ago I saw this movie. It was about high school wrestling. And the heavyweight on a team, he was awful unless there was music playing. If you played music for him, like, he was unbeatable.
Was this Vision Quest, Dave? Was the movie Vision Quest?
It was not Vision Quest. I've searched for it. I watched Vision Quest like twice just to make sure it's not Vision Quest. It's not, okay. Unfortunately. But they would they'd smuggle a record player in. You know, that's how long ago this movie was made. And they'd stick it under one of the chairs and they'd start playing music. Wow, this kid was wrestling and he would dominate. And I feel like I might need that if I got into a fight.
Wow. Okay, so here's, once again, Dave, I wasn't able to answer this question with a single answer. So I've got a couple of options. The first one that came to my mind, actually, I was kind of picturing this as like a spaghetti western type thing. And you picture like the fight starts and then all of a sudden this song comes on while I'm fighting.
You're gonna get hammered listening to this song.
No, but just wait. Porque muy despreciado por eso. No te perdono llorar. You're probably right. I lose the first minute.
Yeah, you're already on the ground bleeding right now.
That's the part that's happening when I'm fighting over and over on loop.
By the time it gets to there, your opponent is like eating chips and salsa because he's already won.
Well, here's the better version then.
Like that fight would there'd be a lot of hijinks going on. Like there'd be a wedgie involved with the old Three Stooges eye poke, that sort of thing.
I feel like for me, when I was imagining this in my mind, my cinematic fighting, I would sort of be like, I would be dressed as a Spanish bullfighter, and it would be like in a Wes Anderson movie somehow. And like for some reason, I was like, this is the perfect soundtrack for how it would be in a fight. It would mostly be me circling with like a fencing sword or something. I don't know. I don't know why I imagined that, but that second song was Hanuman by Rodrigo y Gabriela, and the first one was Bambaleo by the Gypsy Kings, of course. Those are my two bad choices at the beginning, but what do you got, Dave?
So I'm in the fight to win, Steele. I want to get pumped up, but I don't want to pump up the other person. So ideally, it's going to be kind of an off-kilter song with kind of vocals that are a little bit out of tune. I want the other person to be thinking like, wait, what? While I'm getting pumped.
You love that kind of music, Dave.
Yeah. I want the guy to not be like a little bit off on the melody. He's not quite there. So that brought me to this song by Ockerville River, Last Love Song for Now.
If you don't have a bloody nose by the end of that song, you're not listening to it right.
I love that song. For whatever reason, if I'm out running and I put that song on, I go a little bit faster. So I think that would be my only chance to win a fight, is if somehow the fight was about to happen and that song came on. Otherwise, I'm going to lose.
You know, Dave, I played my first two choices for you, but my true choice is actually a little different. I almost didn't want to reveal it to you, but I'll tell you, this song was one I heard. You know, I was telling you when I was coming back from my mission, I listened to the radio on the plane. This is one of the songs I heard. I think there's like a Swedish group, and it's only one set of lyrics repeated over and over again. But this is what I imagine being on the background if I'm in a fight.
If everybody in the world loved everybody in the world, what a glorious world this could be. If everybody in the world loved everybody in the world, what a glorious world this could be.
A that's a little bit sick, yeah. That feels like a scene from like a Quentin Tarantino movie or
something.
Doesn't
it? Yeah, cognitive dissonance there. Yeah, it's me just laying down my arms. Passive, nonviolent resistance, just getting beat up. A little tear rolls down my cheek.
That's a terrific segment, I think. I hope everybody's more ready to fight now.
Yes, those are two questions you really need to have answers to. And you should probably carry the answers in your wallet in case something happens to you and someone needs to know what's your ring entrance music and what do you want on the background if you're in a serious fight.
I've been asking people that throughout the week, actually. Some good responses. It's a great question to ask somebody.
Really is, Dave. Well, I can't believe it, but the time has passed. We're at the end of an episode. And when we come to the end of episode, it means it is time for some book wisdom. Dave, you have some book wisdom for us.
Still, this is from my favorite book by probably my favorite author, Don DeLillo. This is White Noise. You've read this one, right?
Many times. I've even taught this book twice, Dave, in college. A great book.
There's not a lot of books that I've read more than three times. There's not a lot of books I've read more than once. I've read this book like at least five or six times.
Wow. Jack Gladney. What a guy.
So because we were talking about vacation today, kind of the touristiness of America, I got this one small section, and I'm sure you'll remember it when I read it.
Is this the most photographed barn in America?
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and read it.
Great.
Several days later, Murray asked me about a tourist attraction known as the most photographed barn in America. We drove 22 miles into the country around Farmington. There were meadows and apple orchards. White fences trailed through the rolling fields. Soon, the signs started appearing. The most photographed barn in America. We counted five signs before we reached the site. There were 40 cars and a tour bus in the makeshift lot. We walked along a cow path to the slightly elevated spot set aside for viewing and photographing. All the people had cameras. Some had tripods, telephoto lenses, filter kits. A man in a booth sold postcards and slides, pictures of the barn taken from the elevated spot. We stood near a grove of trees and watched the photographers. Murray maintained a prolonged silence, occasionally scrawling some notes into a little book. "No one sees the barn," he said finally. A long silence followed. "Once you've seen the signs about the barn, it becomes impossible to see the barn." He fell silent once more. People with cameras left the elevated site, replaced at once by others. "We're not here to capture an image. We're here to maintain one. Every photograph reinforces the aura. Can you feel it, Jack? An accumulation of nameless energies." There was an extended silence. The man in the booth sold postcards and slides. "Being here is kind of a spiritual surrender. We see only what the others see. The thousands who were here in the past, those who will come in the future, we've agreed to be part of a collective perception. This literally colors our vision, a religious experience in a way, like all tourism." Another silence ensued. "They are taking pictures of taking pictures," he said. He did not speak for a while. We listened to the incessant clicking of shutter release buttons, the rustling crank of levers that advanced the film. "What was the barn like before it was photographed?" he said. "What did it look like? How was it different from other barns? How was it similar to other barns?" "We can't answer these questions because we've read the signs, seen the people snapping the pictures. We can't get outside the aura. We're part of the aura. We're here. We're now." He seemed immensely pleased by this.
So smart, so funny, so savage. What a great book, Dave.
It's the funniest book I've ever read. Anytime I read it, I'll just be sitting there giggling. And it's really intelligent. It's just really interesting, intelligent humor. If I could write like anyone in the world, I would want to write exactly like Don DeLillo in that book.
That's high praise, Dave. Dave, it's been a pleasure. Love talking to you. Thanks, listeners. We'll catch you again next week.
Off the chain. It's off the chain. Welcome to this world.
Oh boy. Today I talked about choices And I should have brought up about how I dropped out of law school. I think that's a good idea. I mean, not the sex toy one, but I'm glad it's held up so well with the amount of use that it's gotten. That's impressive. I've seen some things. The exterminator came by and said one rat can actually produce a ton of poop, because that was like the best choice I've ever made.